session number 10729, Reel 1.
Captain Cunningham, Reel 1. How did the Munich crisis affect your career, please?
The Auxiliary Air Force Squadron that I belonged to, number 604, the County Middlesex, based at Hendon, in company with the other two London squadrons, 600 and 601, were all mobilised for the Munich crisis. And we, with our Hawker Demon biplane single-engine fighters, moved off to our war station North Weald, and with our biplanes we were not very happy because already the German Air Force had got and was using the ME-109 high performance monoplane fighter.
Had you been following aeronautical developments in the German Air Force much?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were very concerned that certainly in the Auxiliary Air Force, were being left far behind. And in the event, by the end of 1938, we were re-equipped with, in the County Middlesex Squadron, the Blenheim twin-engined fighter version.
What was it like to fly?
Oh, the Blenheim was a very nice flying aeroplane, but sadly for us it was a useless war machine because we were a day and night fighter squadron, and our task was, apart from convoy escort work in the day, which took place in the North Sea, we were supposed to be able to fly at night, or we did fly at night, in the hopes of being able to shoot down any intruders at night. But of course, without radar, we did not have radar, of course, at the beginning of the war, in the fighters. The Blenheim was virtually useless. Searchlights were the only aid to pointing out possible enemy aircraft. But the winter of 39, poor weather, clouds, the usual darkness at night, no one was able to really do anything at night here.
Were you dismayed when you heard the announcement that we were at war with Germany?
Not surprised, and all of us were quite convinced from 1938 that that's the condition we would find ourselves in sometime. And in the event when it came, it was no surprise at all to any of us.
Were you surprised that there was this long period of phony war, of inactivity, relatively, before hostilities really started?
Yes, I think we were, all of us, very surprised. And thank heavens, though, that there was this long period of phony activity before the spring of 1940, because it enabled the British aircraft industry to produce some rather better aircraft, and in our case the Bristol Bow fighter, which appeared in the end of August 1940 and was the first twin-engined fighter which was really specifically aimed as a night fighter fitted with radar. Although it was a very early radar and very unreliable, it then gave us a real opportunity to intercept and hopefully shoot down aircraft at night. And we were, of course, with the Bow fighter, armed with four 20mm cannon, which was a tremendous firepower, and a huge advance over the Blenheim, which of course only had machine guns, a few of them, and the Blenheim had no radar.
What kind of duties did you take up in that period between September 1939 and the start of the Battle for France?
We were involved in escorting convoys from the Thames estuary up to the Humber, and night flying, rather ineffectively, whenever any aircraft was reported at night or we were supposed to intercept. We in fact did lose quite a number of our aircraft and air crew just night flying, either through a combination of the bad weather, inexperience, not very satisfactory flying instruments in those Blenheims, and it was a rather discouraging time for us.
Can you tell me about the character of 604 Squadron and any of the particular personalities who stick out in your mind from those early days?
Well, 604 was founded in 1930, and the original founder members were mainly people who had been taught to fly with one of the university air squadrons, and so their age when they joined the squadron was of the order of 22 to 24, and most of them were already working in some business in and around Hendon or London. So that when I joined, which was 5 years after the squadron had been formed, and in the Auxiliary Air Force before the war, your period of engagement was 5 years. So I actually replaced one of the founder members of the squadron whose business was keeping him from spending enough time with the Auxiliary Air Force. Having done his 5 years, I was fortunate to be a replacement for him. They joined straight from school, and I was taught to fly at Hendon by the 604 Squadron. As the Auxiliary Air Force had that capability, each squadron had two training aeroplanes, and the regular Air Force adjutant of the squadron was a Royal Air Force permanent service officer who was also a flying instructor.
When did you first come into combat with the enemy yourself?
Late 1940, and my first combat that brought something down on land in England was in November 1940. And it took us from receiving the blow fighters in the squadron, which was then based at Middle Wallop in Hampshire, and the area that we were supposed to be responsible for really went from the Isle of Wight out towards the Cherbourg Peninsula, and then across the west to include Lyme Bay. So that aircraft coming into England from Brittany and northern France, going up to the Midlands, usually came through our area. So we had a lot of activity of enemy aircraft, particularly, of course, one well remembers the Coventry and Coventry raids and those for the Midlands in November 1940. And it was only at the end of towards the end of that period that I was fortunate to get the first success that the squadron had at night.
Why was it so difficult to get successes in those days?
We, having got the radar in our aircraft, found it a pretty difficult job to both interpret the picture that the radar gave correctly and to have a radar set that worked satisfactorily. As often as not, the radar just the electric got hot, or the radar collapsed, or in many cases we had what was called a squint on the radar, which our aeroplanes used to live outside the whole time, and through wet or when it rained heavily, moisture got into the aerial system and would give a false indication of where the target was. As a consequence of that, every afternoon before we got our aircraft ready for the, or to get them ready for the night operation, we always had to go off in pairs, one as a target, the other as the fighter, so that our radar operator in our own aircraft could check his equipment and see if the target, when it was really dead ahead, was showing ahead, or if it's the left, it showed to the left. But as often as not, the indications that we got didn't line up with where the aircraft was, and so back you'd go on the ground and say, it doesn't work, or it's got a squint. Well, the problem of fixing that and getting a reliable picture was a pretty big one. And of course, we had to learn the limitations of the equipment. Both pilots and our radar operators were new to the job, and learning on the job was not easy. And the in the first few months, the Bow fighters that we received were a total handful on instruments, because loaded up with the cannon ammunition, they were flying in a condition which was they were unstable in pitch, so that flight on instruments was almost a whole time job just to keep the aircraft flying safely. And there were, in fact, quite a number of losses of aircraft, not through combat, but through flight problems. So it was a lengthy business, and eventually, when I was fortunate enough, together with Jimmy Rawnsley, who was had been my air gunner in the biplane fighters, became eventually my radar operator. We remained together through the whole war. He was an electrical engineer by profession in peacetime, and he had a good brain and understanding of aircraft and flying generally, and between the two of us we were able to achieve considerable success.
Was it easy for the pilots and the operator to fall out with each other because of these problems?
Oh yes, there were numbers of pilots who said, oh god, if it's not the set, it's the chap who's operating the set. And it was frustrating to many people, particularly that when the set did give out some hot smells or something, and all the picture vanished, but all the radar operator could do was give it a sharp blow, and of course that didn't sometimes produce an answer, but it was very discouraging, and so back you would go and abandon the flight.
A sharp blow?
Yes, with a foot or hand. I mean, it was electrical boxes, and oh god, there's nothing you can do except give it a blow and hope that something happens. Well, sometimes it did, as often as not it didn't.
Can you describe the incident in which you had your first success?
Well, sadly, the combat report, I was asked only very recently, did I have a copy? Well, I don't have any copy. And I said, oh, I'm sure they're in the public records office. So the person who wrote to me duly went to the public record office at Kew and found, to his astonishment, that many, or I'm not sure whether all, but the combat reports that I was interested in 604 Squadron, were not there. They had been taken, borrowed, or removed, and they were not able to say where they were. I can only remember it was a marginal affair in the sense that it was not very nice weather. There was a certain amount of cloud, and my first sight of the target that I was following or led on to by, if I remember correctly, searchlights showing on cloud towards which I flew, and my radar operator, who at that time was not Jimmy Rawnsley, but he was still under training. He had been my air gunner before, and it was an operator called John Phillipson, who was pretty inexperienced in flying, but an intelligent chap who eventually became a good operator. But he said, "I have a radar contact, and it's ahead, but I've forgotten, but a mile and a half or 2 miles, and it's going to the right." So I naturally turned, and that's what the searchlights are probably trying to see or find, and what I want to see. Well, we closed in, the range reduced, and got to some 1,000 feet or some range ahead, and slightly above. We always came in with the aim of being able to look up at this, whatever the target was. And I saw exhaust flames, which were bluish. So I thought, that's it. Now, what is it? So I went in underneath, and I was uncertain. It was, in fact, a Junkers 88. But I went in underneath, being, from our point of view, although there were gunners beneath most of these bombers, they were less likely to see you if you were beneath them than if you were above them. And we, from our position in the cockpit in the front of the aircraft, always had a good view forward and up. And I decided, fine, this is a German aircraft. Now I'm going to climb up towards its own height, because we had to be very nearly their own height and pointing at them to get our cannon to bear through and use the gun sight. We had a very primitive gun sight, which it was a ring and a bead only, illuminated electrically with a rheostat beside one's left hand to adjust the light intensity. But of course, being in the dark, and it was just a very dark night with cloud, although I'd seen the exhaust flames and the outline of the aircraft, when I came up to nearly its own level to shoot at it, looking through this sight, which was far too bright, even turned down to its dimmest, wasn't very accurate shooting, but anyway, I hit it, and the whole thing went down beneath me suddenly, and then we lost radar contact. And to me, oh dear, I'm uncertain. I've hit it, but whether it's final, I don't know. I then returned to Middle Wallop, and our observer corps in the area reported hearing this combat and an aircraft coming down and finishing up near Angering. It's near on the south coast.
Presumably there must have been great delight.
Oh yes, there was at least enormous relief, because the vast effort that the country was putting into night fighter work to try and begin to counter the enormous raids that had been taking place almost without any interception or opposition from the country. Although the anti-aircraft guns did their best, there were night squadrons with these expensive aircraft and all this vast effort put into radar, and yet we didn't seem to have success. But fortunately, the squadron based at Middle Wallop was learning, and we fairly rapidly built on our successes, certainly during the January, February, March of 41, we built up a very successful record in numbers of aircraft intercepted and shot down.
Did you personally come across criticisms from the public or even from within the RAF on the lines of what on earth are our fighter pilots doing to stop this terrible damage?
Yes, there was a small amount of the night fighters, they fly around at night, what on earth they're doing, but most of the day fighter squadron chaps, they did not like night flying, number one, and secondly, they thought, oh God, no, that's a rather grim and unrewarding and not a very satisfying operation. So they didn't have really any particular desire to do the night flying themselves. And it wasn't until, of course, the end of 1940 that the night squadrons did begin to achieve some success. And from that time onwards, there was very considerable interest in getting into a night fighter squadron.
How had you come into night fighting yourself originally?
The squadron. The squadron, 604, was designated in 1936 as a day and night fighter squadron when 604 became part of the fighter command organization, which was formed in 1936. And the auxiliary Air Force squadrons all became part of fighter command. So some were given day squadron activities, day fighter squadrons, and those, when they were re-equipped just before the war, had single-engine fighters, Hurricanes or Spitfires, and those of us that were day and night squadrons received Blenheims and subsequently Bow fighters, and were twin engine fighters because they had longer range, and for night flying you needed longer range and endurance, longer endurance particularly, because the single engine fighters used to, when a few of them did fly by night, very often got lost, ran out of fuel, and then were written off.
As far as the Bow fighter is concerned, did you develop, you and your brother pilots, did you develop an affection for the aeroplane as people developed it towards the Spitfire?
Oh, yes, very much so. I think the Bow fighter was quite one of the most outstanding night fighters, not only because it was the first one that was successful, but it was built very toughly and would take an enormous amount of punishment, and it had good armament, it had plenty of fuel so that it could stay in the air for quite a long time, and it had the Bristol Hercules air-cooled radial engines, which were fine, powerful, and being air-cooled, they didn't rely on big radiators, which were vulnerable to fire either from the bombers that you were attacking, or more likely if you hit them would get damaged by bits that flew off the bomber that you were shooting at. And as subsequently happened with the Mosquito, which replaced the Bow fighter, when used as a night fighter, the Mosquito had to replace the Bow fighter because the performance of the Bow fighter was not good enough to deal with the German bombers or German aircraft used as bombers later in the war, and the far superior Mosquito performance gave Mosquito the capability of intercepting and shooting down the German single-engine fighters that were used towards the end of the war, Focke-Wulf 190, for example. But the Mosquito relied on the Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, which were marvellous engines, but all the space between the engines and the fuselage was filled up by a radiator for the engines. And when you went close behind an aircraft and shot at it and hit it at night, bits and pieces of the aircraft you hit would come back, and many times would one or other of your radiators would get punctured, and you lose the coolant and have to stop the engine. So the Beaufighter, though, being air-cooled, did not. It was a marvellous close-in war machine, but it wasn't fast enough to be continued in use as a night fighter from 1943 onwards. So from 1940 to 42, I had those 2 years on Beaufighters. I thought it absolutely marvellous. Of course, it was the first aircraft that made night fighting with radar possible.
What were the developments in the winter of 40-41, the improvements that actually took place, which enabled the Air Force to start to try to get on top of the Blitz bombers?
Oh, well, the radar, it was mainly through the enormous effort and success of the brains that were applied to the development of radar, and that, of course, is a story in itself through the radar research establishment that that were eventually centred at Malvern. But before that, there was a period when a lot of the work was done at Swanage, and some very fine brains were used in the teams that devised better forms of radar, and particularly, of course, the introduction of the 10-centimetre radar, which did away with the problem entirely of external aerials on our fighters and was replaced by a scanner in the nose of the aircraft that was enclosed inside the nose of the aircraft. And that had, the 10-centimetre radar had tremendous advanced capabilities compared to the large dipoles and the early radar, which was depended on, I think, the 1.5 metre wavelength, and which meant that with the early radar, the maximum range that we could see ahead from our fighter was somewhat less than our height above the ground. So if we were flying at 10,000 feet altitude, we might see up to 8,000 feet ahead, and you would have a very limited range when looking down. But with the centimetre radar, you could see 10,000 feet, you could see at least 10,000 feet ahead, possibly more if the set was a good one, and you could